And welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Benched with Bubba, episode 611. We are back after a little hiatus on the show. I've been doing Bubba in the Bloom, doing some other things, but Benched with Bubba took a little breather here. We are back. We got a lot of stuff scheduled down the line here, so we're back for a 2020 season, as you'd expect. But to get us rolling in the 2024 is a friend of the show, a friend of mine. I got the pleasure of seeing him once again in Arizona a little over a week ago. He won the 2023 Online Auction Championship at the NFBC, and he's got his own website over there at DC Dynasty. He's got all kinds of great stuff there. You can find him on Twitter at Lucas Beery. Lucas, how are we doing, my friend?
I'm doing great, Bubba. Thank you for having me on. Really excited to just talk a little bit of auction, talk some second half players and everything in between. So yeah, fired up.
Yeah, we're having some fun here. Lucas crushed his auction, and I was picking his brain in Arizona because I've talked about on this show before and Bubba the Bloom that my goal is to do at least one auction. Like, I love the concept of the auction, so I'm really looking forward to talk to Lucas about strategy and whatnot there. And it the beautiful thing about auctions, like regular drafts, is it varies from person to person. So it'll be fun to get Lucas's thoughts on this. But before we dig into that, Lucas, why don't you let everybody know about DC Dynasty and what else you got going on over there? Because I know you just did like a lessons learned or something like that recently on there. And just let everybody know it's a great free resource out there.
Yeah. So I have a website called dcdynasty.co. And right now I'm going to be focusing on draft champions. And I'm also going to do some articles on late round starting pitchers to pick up or fade possibly. I think I'm going to go division by division. So AL East, AL Central, et cetera. So that'll kind of give me something to do for this year. And then possibly get into some position stuff. I have articles on draft champions content, some dynasty content. I did auction last year. I did some gladiator too, but I'm actually not going to be in the gladiator format this year. I don't really like that you don't get to interact with the team, but yeah, you can find some of my various content on DC Dynasty.
Yeah, I highly recommend checking it out, Lucas. We've had him on the show before. I think last time we had him on was too long ago, but we talked to not the Cardinals. It was some team I couldn't find a home for, and Lucas helped. I think with D-backs maybe, or
it was the Rangers.
Rangers. That's what. Yeah, the team that won it all. Lucas helped with the team that won it all. Go figure. I hit him up because I wanted to have him on the show anyways. I'm like, hey, I need your help. I know you're wise in all aspects of fantasy baseball, so I know you can fill in and help me out here. We had a blast doing that, but that was right when you were getting ready, I think, or just had started your DC Dynasty. We're kind of talking about that stuff. So it's been great content over there. There's an amazing waiver wire column out there. There's a lot of great waiver wire columns, a lot of them behind paywalls, a lot of them not. Lucas's is not. It's very in-depth and good stuff there. But the DC stuff, Lucas is smart there. And I like the concept of doing it division by the division for the pitchers, especially because like I'll do mine position by position, but I think it might be even better to do a divisional situations like that. But I won't let everything behind the curtains come out, but it was very funny to me because the running joke, it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek joke, but weirdly sadly true because I do live in the world of catchers. So I get a text from Lewis the other day about like he's at a certain part of his draft, and I'm like, hey, what catchers? And I'm like, yeah, you came to the right place. Like, I'll help you in the depth of DCs right here. So
well,
yeah, it's pretty fun.
I let catcher go, which last year I was sometimes taking two high catchers thinking it was a big advantage. And I'm rethinking that with the catcher pool getting so much deeper. And It was, you know, around, I think maybe round 22 or so, I got Henry Davis as my catcher too, but obviously he's not eligible there. So I figured I would just dumpster dive, got a hold of you, and I grabbed Corey Lee in like the 36th round. So I'm not excited about that, but he'll get some at-bats here and there and we'll see what happens.
He'll get at bats, and Henry Davis is, if you believe coach speak, should gain catcher eligibility for a couple weeks' time because they wanted to get back to catcher, which, you know, as the catching guy myself, I'm like, well, then what's that mean for Andy Rodriguez? Because that's still a young guy with potential Pittsburgh that stuff going on, let's put it that way. But this is what I love about the show, and we can kind of divert around here. You mentioned I talked about my Substack when I put my early catcher rankings out there. There's so many ways to go about it, especially in DCs. Like James Anderson talked about it when they recapped our early first seven rounds of our early DC we did, and he took a couple catchers early. Some guys want to get like one good catcher, and then they'll fill in the rest later. Some wait with the depth of catcher. I agree. Like I'm doing a 50s right now. And in the 13th, the 14th round, I got Bo Naylor and another stud. I can't remember now, but young ball player. that won't last, obviously, but it shows the depth of the pools where I was going with this. And it shows if you have your plan in place, you can make it work. And if you kind of don't wait on catcher, you maybe don't have to take four catchers late, but otherwise, like, there's a whole strategy to it. So as a DC guy that's doing DC Dynasty, of course, is this your first DC you're doing?
Yeah, it's my first DC. I've held off a little while, and on the plane back, or on the airport back from Arizona, I figured, let's just jump into one of these puppies before the year flips. And then on Monday, the second day of the draft, all the ADP was updated. All the positions were updated. So I'm like, well, if I had any advantage on having every position mapped out, that's gone. So, but yeah.
Out the window. But what are you seeing so far that stands out to you? Because you're that was around 36 the other day, so you're probably close to done, if not done by now. What are you seeing? Kind of, is there anything that stands out? Have you might have gone really looked deep into it yet, but is there a position or a strategy that you might think might be better than the other so far?
First base is a position that in a draft champions league, I think I could have waited on a little bit more. I had pick 11, so I went with Garrett Cole in the first round. And then in the second round, there was no speed available that I felt good about. And I was debating between Austin Riley and Matt Olson. Went with Matt Olson because I think he'll hit more home runs, maybe more counting stats too. But then I was not able to get a guy like Justin Turner later on, or Ty France in the mid 300s. So first base is one of those positions, and I didn't want to fill my utility that quickly, just because I would be totally log jammed with Matt Olson. And then filling in that utility too quickly would be tricky. But yeah, first base is a deep position. Outfield is another deep position too. I was able to get Alex Verdugo in the reserve rounds, which was surprising to me. And there was countless outfielders I would have been happy with, but I had already filled up so quickly. So yeah, I guess just pounding middle infield quickly, because there's a huge drop off with shortstops that a lot of guys acknowledge in the chat room. And I'm for getting pitching early this year. A lot of people are saying because pitching was so volatile that, you know, you can wait and get, you know, a Kyle Bradish late, or, you know, maybe you can find a Grayson Rodriguez late for this coming year. I want to get my pitching early. So get the best of the best, get a Garrett Cole, who's Mr. Consistent. So that's my approach.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's weird because pitching, I've found myself at least trying to get a couple guys earlier, like not first round maybe, but in the first X amount of rounds, kind of be anchored down, I guess, is one way to look at it, because it does pop off into an uncomfortable world of, like you mentioned, Kyle Bradish. That's one I stared at for rounds, and someone else finally took him. But I'm like, yeah, he had a great season in an amazing 2023. Can we expect that in 2024? Like, that's a great, like, can he do it twice type thing? There's a lot of those questions in that realm of pitching where, you know, 50% I do pitch the same or better, and then 50% you wouldn't be shocked if they just completely hit the wall again. Like, it's just a really weird, weird world. Last thing I'll ask you on this, because this wasn't part of the outline, but just out of curiosity, a popular topic of conversation that's going to be talked about probably on every show that I do, unfortunately, and others, all these rookie guys that were called up last year, and some people were on board with that in DCs and late rounds, and it paid off great. Other ones, like Matt McClain, wasn't even really drafted. It was like, there's certain guys that weren't even drafted in even DCs, the 50 round drafts. And you're just like, wow, okay, I get it, but whatever. So now the talk is, how aggressive are we in DCs this year? Now, being your first DC, are you being aggressive? Are you seeing people being aggressive? Is it a thing that might still take some time to kind of unravel as, you know, draft season goes? Or is this just a 1 year thing? Like, how are you looking at those young prospects that might get called up, like taking chances later in drafts?
Yeah, so I think whenever it comes to prospects, I think the redraft community is very reactive based on what they just saw. So last year, we had a historic crop of pitchers come up, and I found in this draft that pitching prospects have gotten really boosted up and are going really high compared to previous years. In addition to that, I think the pitching prospect pool, and we got a chance to talk to some of the biggest prospect guys in first pitch, and they said that the prospect pitching pool was drained out from last year, and a lot of the big guns were already pulled out. So you're taking an asset higher that's at a worse quality, and you're paying more for it because of recency bias. So for me, I didn't draft my first pitching prospect until round 37. So there was guys that were more aggressive. There were certain pitching prospects I did want, but they just went a round or two earlier than I wanted to go. Now, as far as some of the hitting prospects, there are certainly some really elite ones there. You know, Wyatt Langford, he went fairly high in this draft. You know, a guy like Jackson Churio, for me, I wouldn't be surprised if he was to crack the opening day roster with a strong spring training. So there's certainly some really nice hitting prospects. But I think overall, the minor leagues was depleted a lot from last year's aggressive call-ups based on the new rules. Teams trying to get that draft pick, and they also know, hey, if this guy has an MLB-ready pitch, or if we think that he's going to provide value at the MLB level, they're calling him up. They're not wasting any bullets or service time.
I agree completely. That's one of the things I've kind of mentioned with some other guys, either in person in FPAS or whatnot, is there's only so many people that can get called up. And we had so many of them called up last year. It's like, how do we expect that many to be ready again? Like, it's just the way of development works. How's that going to take place? And maybe I get proven wrong, but I'm giving that same set that you were talking about, that we had so many called up last year. How are we possibly going to have that many called up this next year? And so a guy like myself that doesn't prospects that great, I'm probably going to stick to my boring, just beautiful, and my Dane Dunnings of the world and just kind of like go with it and see what happens. Not nearly as fun. I get it. But that's just like my comfort zone, and maybe it'll change someday. But I was just curious to see how you were seeing that unfold, because it's going to be a wild landscape going through the next few months of DCs, especially to see these guys get called up. The more news you hear come out from teams about, you know, the Jack Churios and stuff, and people get excited for good reasons. And I'd be willing to take more hitter chances than pitching chances for sure. But there's going to be a lot of that to go around. So it'll be a fun top conversation.
Yeah. I kind of aside closer to you. Like I said, I waited till round 37 until I finally went with the pitching prospect, because some of the top guys could possibly debut quickly, but at the same time, it's a risk. I mean, people probably thought Kyle Harrison, one of your boys, would come up quicker than he did. And it's a risk. That's why in years past, the prospects were waited on, but now people are more aggressive than ever in my mind.
Yep. 100% with you on that. Let's talk about auctions though. This is where Lucas shined. He's, like I said, he's always been a really good fantasy player. This is where he got to show his moxie this past year, because he won the overall in the auction championship. Let's start with the basics here. How many years have you been playing the auction championship? How many bullets did you have this last year? Let's talk about the basics for the NFBC Auction Championship. So what was this your first time? How many times have you done it? How many leagues did you have?
Yeah, so my first experience doing an auction league was on Yahoo 2015 or 2016. And then I jumped over to Fantrax with some of the guys from Baseball 365. Jumped over to Fantrax auctions in 2017 with Justin Hughes and played in that league for, I think, 3 or 4 years. And I was able to cash in that league from time to time, and I believe I won it too. But that was a few years running. And I didn't actually jump into NFBC auctions until 2022. I did a team there. I just did one team. And it's funny because I grinded away at it because I had a bad auction. I did horrible, but I was able to chip away eventually over the course of the season. And I jumped into third place to get some money back, but I tied for third. And then on a stat correction, it changed the next day, which kind of was irritating, but you know, it happens. So anyways, so that was last year. And then this year I did two of the online auction championship leagues. Thankfully I was able to win both of those leagues, but this is just my second year in this format on NFBC, but I've been doing auctions for years.
Were you sweating the overall for a while, or was it just kind of like, cause I remember, I think I was telling Bloomfield before one of our shows, I get the weekly email. It shows like the people that are leading certain competitions. And I'm like, all of a sudden I saw Lucas's name up there and I'm like, oh, let's go. Like, it's someone I know, let's make it happen. So how was the sweat take down the whole thing?
So, and I hadn't really experienced this since I'd never been in an overall mix, but based on how many teams are in the competition, like with the online championship, I know that you can move like 200-400 points in a day because there's so many more teams. In this one, I had noticed towards the last few weeks, the guy next to me or any guys in the top 5 or top 10, they could really only move like 100 points per day at most. I would move 50 and they could move 50. So it wasn't like they could catch like 300-400 points every night. And going into that final weekend, I was up by like 200 points. And really, I was just cheering for the other guy to do bad, because that would help me out a lot too, since third place was a ways away. But it was a concern at times, but it wasn't like I was stressing out like Brian Slack and Dylan White when they won the main event overall. They were a lot more worried. I was certainly worried, but I knew it would take a few miraculous days for the other guy, and that didn't happen, thankfully.
Awesome. That's great to hear, because I did hear about the Slack deal by talking like Justin and Toby and all those guys that are hanging out with them. And it was literally even Justin when he won his league. Like, it came down to the last at bats type situations. And it, you hear all these stories all the time. It's just like, man, like, you talk stat corrections, and this is minor, but like, I went from winning a DC to tying a DC because of whatever that game wasn't supposed to count, and they threw it in there later on type thing. And I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. Like, this is crazy. So I can only imagine sweating on an overall like that. Yeah. So it's gotta be kind of nice to sit there and just enjoy it for a little bit. You've been doing auctions for a while. So let's have a little fun. Kind of, like I said earlier in the show, is there's many ways to do an auction. People talk star scrubs, people talk balance, people talk putting like 70% into hitting, 30% into pitching, so many ways to go about it. So let's talk with the basics here. Your budget is, was it like 260 in an auction? 260.
Or, yeah. 260. That's the, okay. That's the normal number.
And when you are drafting your auction team, are you drafting like 23 and then you have reserve rounds, or how does that go?
Yes. All the auctions I've ever done, and from what I've seen, you just auction off your 23 and then you'll do a snake draft for the rest of the 7-man bench.
Now, before we get into the auction part of it, when you know you're only adding, you're doing 23, and then you're doing 7 more in a snake draft, does that impact how you're building your team, or is it just kind of like, we'll see how we build the team and then the picks in the snake, we'll adjust there? You have a plan in place, basically.
Yes, it does affect things. And I actually learned this from Zach Waxman, listening to his podcast, because he's a very regular in the online auction streets. So if you have 15 teams in your league and you have 9 pitching spots, most teams will go 7 starting pitchers and 2 relievers. And then other teams will go with 6 starting pitchers and 3 relievers. So let's say on average, they take 6.5 starting pitchers times 15 teams. You're getting down to maybe like pitcher 95. Starting pitcher 95. So there can be good starting pitchers that are available, whether they're prospect stashes or they're just guys that are overlooked in the reserve round. So the reserve rounds are typically filled up with interesting pitchers. So that's one strategy. And that means to me that I can take a few $1 pitchers and then load up even more in the reserve rounds just to get more starting pitcher bullets for my, you know, SP7 or SP6 possibly.
That makes a lot of sense. This is why we're having the show here. That's very interesting, because you see, I'll watch a lot of them. Like, maybe some guys don't want to pay for catchers, so they're like, screw it, the reserve rounds, I'll go get my catcher too. That's an option, because I've talked about it. Maybe you can stream catchers. So if that's your strategy going into it, that's a way, even though you can probably get dollar catchers and feel more comfortable before you even hit the bench part of things. But the pitching thing is very, very intriguing there, because it allows you to load up on bats, like you said, maybe get a couple elite pitchers. So that'll take me to my next point. Are you a stars and scrubs guy? Are you a balanced guy? How do you approach the draft room?
It's dependent on each year. Sometimes it's different. Every room's different too. A lot of guys will go into an auction with this sheet, and they'll have their prices for all the different players. And some guys will not deviate. They'll say, if this guy's a $45 player on my list and he's going for 47, I'm not touching him. So I really just kind of feel out the room, and you can usually tell how the prices are escalating. I lean towards stars and scrubs, but guess what? A lot of people do, because people like to have first round talents on their teams. So going into this year, for this particular team that brought down the overall, my highest spend was Garrett Cole. And some players are going in the high 40s in the auctions, and Cole only went for $35. So I went a little bit more balanced with this one, but I still purchased Garrett Cole, Bo Bichette, Rafael Devers, 3 guys that are top 20 ADP guys from last year. Kind of a hybrid almost, in a sense.
You still got some elite, but you didn't go crazy, which is good, because it allows you to get some talent later on. Like I picked Toe's Brain, like Rob DiPietro, and some other guys at FPAS, because they've been doing this for a long time as well with the auctions. And they talked about that. The Stars scrubs approach makes sense if you can pull it off, like if you know what scrubs you want type thing. At the same time, like kind of the way you did, you still get some very good guys without paying a premium.
Yes.
It allows you to lock in more stable, potentially better of the scrub tier, if that makes sense. Like just outside the scrub tier, maybe like that middle tier of really good guys that, yeah, the scrub guys can be good. And if they hit their ceiling, okay, awesome. But these other guys, their floor, like will smash your scrubs, if that makes sense to people out there. And that gives you a much better floor leaving the draft room. That's why for me, I'd probably be a very boring drafter in this deal. Like I'd probably be more of a balanced guy. But then again, I've told guys, there's certain players you love and I have a problem like spending too much and then putting myself in a hole. So that leaves me like my next question is, how do you price enforce? Do you go and make like an SGP list? How do you go about going, okay, Gerrit Cole, I got for 36. I have him rated as an X amount player. I'm willing to go this high. How do you go about that with your player pool?
Before I answer that, I just wanted to throw out one more quick thing. And this is just kind of, this is one thing I did from the first auction on was I would see what the first round players were going for. And I would want to get one of the cheapest elite guys. So to give you an example, let's say the first round players next year are going for 45, 46, 47 bucks. If I can get Kyle Tucker for less than 40, that's an automatic value in my mind. So more of a caveman approach, not as systematic, but that's something I've been doing for years and it's worked out pretty good.
I respect that.
Caveman approach. but as far as values, I did something a lot different this year for my auctions. I actually listened to a podcast that Rob DiPietro did, and he had an NFBC legend, Brody Johns, on. And Brody Johns, he had won the Platinum Auction 5 out of the last 6 years. So pretty much a legendary performance for such a high entry league. And one of his biggest keys, he has many keys, but one of the takeaways I had was for each and every position, he would have 4, 5, 6 of the most perfect $1 players. So that way he has options upon options upon options, because you need to have a wide selection list of the player pool. So what I did was I went through the average auction value, which is available on the NFBC website, and I color coded each guy, my feelings on them, dark green or double green if I really liked them, red if they were in a void, and certain guys that I'd be okay with if they came really cheap. So it's not an SGP or anything, but it was just a really thorough scrub of who gets auctioned. And since only 23 guys get auctioned per team, it's not like this list was, 500 people long. It was like 300 some odd players. So it was pretty quick to do, actually.
And that's a great point that I think I speak out of my rear end here. I don't think it gets talked about enough that when we draft most of these, we're talking, 30 times 12, 30 times 15. Now you're doing the 23. And that definitely changes the whole player pool. Now, if you're doing 260 with only 23 players, that's an average of almost $11.50 a player, give or take. So if you start factoring in, say you take like 5 $1 players, and now you have 255 divided by 18, now you're talking closer to $15 a player. And it's just a way to pencil things out, I guess, which is because we always just talk about, these guys are worth this much and so on and so forth. But we talk roster construction redrafts all the time, like on snake drafts. Well, we should be talking roster constructions on auctions, obviously, as well. And that's the way I think to do it is walking in there. I like the point, like have 5 or 6 of your better $1 players. If I can go and get even 2 or 3 of those guys, well, that allocates money elsewhere type scenario and changes your kind of, I don't know, philosophy is the right word, but like you said, caveman approach. I love the idea of just the list and color coding. And that's definitely something I basically do on snake drafts anyways. So I think that's very, very interesting. You said every draft's different, so some are stars and scrubs, some are balanced, so on and so forth. But in your preference, do you prefer to go like a certain percentage hitting, certain percentage pitching, or is it up for grabs? Like I'd imagine you have a preference, but it always changes as the draft changes.
Yeah. So as far as the hitter pitcher split, funny enough, that's actually a number that, from listening to the best players and just kind of keeping my ear to the ground, a lot of them are saying their pitching budget needs to go up every year. Used to, you could get away with $160 on hitting and $100 on pitching. Now $100 is a minimum. You're probably looking more at $120. That way you can bring in guys with more guaranteed ratios, more innings, and better strikeout per inning numbers, and possibly even spend up on two closers that if you come out of the draft with, you know, a $20 closer and a $15 closer, you're not as in a rush and fab to go pick up that flavor of the month. So spending more on pitching is a strategy that I've just listened to some of the more veteran players do. And I've tried to allocate more and more towards pitching just to get more reliable pitching guys. And that way don't stream off the waiver wire, which will just destroy you. And you can stream your hitters off the waiver wire, which is not going to be nearly as damaging.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like that's one topic of conversation for the last year or so is, let's just start streaming hitters instead of pitchers. Why are we so focused on streaming pitchers? Let's draft good pitchers. So I guess same makes total sense in the auction strategy of things to see how that goes. Now, forgive me. Were you in the auction draft at FPEZ? I think you were, weren't you?
No. I was a few years ago, but Will Garofalo, he was in there this year. Yeah, our boy Will.
Big G. Yeah, no, because I sat in there and watched for a little bit. And I was watching some of the closers, and like a handful of them were going for like $5 to $10, give or take. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there going, to me, that felt cheap. This is where my novice of not knowing the situation type thing. But are you a fan of getting two of the, I guess, higher tier closers in an auction? Does it change between auction and redrafts for you, or is it the same in both? I keep saying redrafts, snake drafts, auction. They're both redrafts, but yeah.
On paper, it sounds really good, and I'm sure it could be done. But on the team that won it this year, I had a $17 Ryan Pressly, which was perfect. He did the job, didn't get hurt. And then I got what really helped was a $4 Paul Sewald. And it's funny because I wasn't even that excited about it because Munoz was kind of going to split with him, if not take over the role. And I just figured at $4, I was like, let's give it a chance. Ratios, and he'll give me a start to the season until I can find something better. So I think it's good to get the one closer with the job and then hope to get lucky with it, with another cheap guy, just because you can't have everything. You need to know exactly where to skimp, and you need to be able to get lucky some places and save money. And I think on that, like $1 to $5 closer, if you can figure out who that guy is, that's going to set you up really good.
Nice. When it comes to nominating players, now this is a fun one because I've heard people say nominate guys that people are going to love so they go and spend money so I don't have to worry about it. And there's other guys like, well, I want to nominate guys I want because if I somehow get stuck with them, I want to make sure I have them type scenario. how do you go about your nominating process? Because it seems simple, but there's obviously a science behind it.
Yes, there's absolutely a science behind it. And I think no matter what you do with your nomination, there's many ways you can use your nomination, but you need to get some sort of information somehow. No closers have gone off the board. Let's throw Josh Hader out there, see what the top dog goes for. And if you like the price, get in, but you can at least say, well, if he went for $26, if I can get another elite closer for 22 or 23, I can live with that. Or let's say that, you know, you've got one or two ace starting pitchers and there's only two or three left that are elite. Well, if you want to see some money fly off the board and other people are getting worried about their starters, you can put that guy out there and just kind of get rid of what's left in the tier. One other thing I like to do is any of the high buzz players, like a Matt McClain or a Noel V. Marte, if you throw those guys out there, they're going to get money off the board as well. So some people think that that's a bad idea because they think that that money is going to come off the board no matter what. But in my mind, I'd rather get those big buzz guys off the board before the budgets are diminished, because halfway through when the budgets start to get lower, that's when the values and the cheaper players come across. So I want to get the big buzz guys out early, get that money spent, and go from there.
I love that. I love that strategy because, yeah, later on then you can get some guys that maybe went for $22, but since the money's gone, go get them for $18 or something. And that's definite value and can start saving that cash left and right, and now you're not spending dollars at the end. You get $2, you get the guys you want because you've got $2 and everyone only has a dollar, so on and so forth. It's definitely a strategy involved there. Obviously, you said you won both your leagues. This is your first time in an overall competition. So when you're, I'm assuming when you're drafting, you're just drafting to win your league, or were you drafting purposely for an overall?
Yeah. Did not think about the overall at all because just based on the odds, it was low. But I just wanted to, and I'm a veteran drafter. I want to draft for a high floor. I want to mitigate the risk. So I'm not thinking I'm going to go for the overall. Obviously I knew it was a possibility, even though it would be a long shot. And I was just playing at my team and looked in the middle of the summer. And actually, funny enough, somebody was like, dude, I'm cheering for you or I see what you're doing in the auction overall. I'm like, holy shit. I looked, it was like late July. I'm like, man, I should have been paying much closer attention to this. And then since then I started micromanaging it as much as I could. But yeah, I was just trying to win the league and really everything just kind of came together as far as some luck and put myself in a good position at times, but it was just bad things didn't really happen. And I got lucky a whole bunch and a few other players hit. So it was no secret recipe per se. It was just good fortune across the board.
I love how you say that because people always say, you know, you got to be super skilled to win. And there's definitely like you are very super skilled to win. A lot of the guys, Brian Slack and Dylan White, very super skilled to win. But you also said the other part there. We still have to get lucky. It's a 6-month season. We have to avoid injuries. Like the fact you admit that a lot of guys, like I think they cringe when they say that stuff. It's just being realistic here. Like if you avoided the injuries, you know, you struck gold on a guy that was many people liked, but didn't think he'd be that good. Like there's just certain things that, like the year Vlad finally erupted and you were on, like people were on Vlad. That's great. But has he done it since? No, but you're on him that year and he probably helped you win. Like it's little things like that. And when you're on the right people, you avoid the injuries. So the fact you admitted it, I appreciate because not enough people say they hear the word luck and they think it's like a negative connotation and it's not, it's just, you ran pure is the way I look at it. And that's how you hit the overalls. That's the big, like you can win leagues without running pure, but to win an overall, you definitely have to do that. So you said you noticed in about July or something when a friend hit up on and you started micromanaging it more. Obviously you won it all. So I'm not gonna say it hurt you, but do you think you would have been just fine if you didn't micromanage it? Do you think it benefited you a lot? Like, cause I know some guys you listen to like the Robs and all those guys that play in mini leagues, main event leagues, all that stuff. They hardcore on like every week, look at the overall numbers, doing all these things that just, I don't know if my brain can wrap my head around half the stuff they talk about. Do you think it benefited you? And maybe it's a trait you'll continue on now to micromanage it the way you did.
I think you need to start micromanaging at a point, but I was still putting out my absolute best lineups. I was getting as much playing time as possible. Saves was one thing I needed. So I needed to get my saves. That's not a bad thing to have to catch up in because you can just change your SPRP split. No big deal if you can find the saves. And also steals is another thing I needed, which was tough for me because some of the steals guys are just not very good players. So it's uncomfortable for me to put them in. Like an Alex Young from the Washington Nationals, you know, he might have a decent career, but he's not as good of a hitter as some of the other guys that you can put in there that are going to be home run guys. Or just looking at the WRC plus, if you look at that for steals guys, it's going to be worse than the other players. But yeah, at a point you need to start micromanaging it, but you can wait a little while for everything to, cause you still need to build your base really good. And then come the last 2 months, maybe last 3 months, if you want to go in July, then that's when you need to hone in, look at each category and figure out where you can move up.
Yeah, that's why I was wondering, because I'm, again, not the guy to micromanage and discuss micromanaging, but I feel like you got to let the team breathe for a few months before you start really letting it go. And I just feel like sometimes I wonder if it's some are overmanaged potentially. It's where, like, I love Mike Curlin. I don't know if you listen to the show, but we watched Curlin's saga last year. He was on my show most Mondays, and was micromanaging out the gate, and most of the time worked really well. Other times it backfired on him, and it makes me just wonder if, you know, the wait and see approach for at least a little while is a good thing. But that's a conundrum. Year to year can be different. You mentioned stolen bases are tough to get later on, saves you can get. Going back to when you auction your team, are you, since you have the ability to get who you want, are you more category dependent, like focused on certain categories? Then obviously in a snake draft, you still want to be balanced or get, X amount of steals and everything. But are you more aggressive in an auction to go and get maybe a high yields guy, other type scenarios like that?
Yeah, I am more aggressive to get my steals because you have your pick of the litter. If you have a particular steals guy, if you have your particular steals guy that you like, Kyle Tucker, let's say that you think he's kind of just no warts, good batting average, great home run potential, you can go ahead and get him, and you don't have to be in that second round, kind of like I was saying with my DC, where you don't feel good about any steals guys, and then you reach for an Ellie De La Cruz if you think he's a reach at that turn in the first, second round. So, yeah, you can be a lot more choosy with your steals guys in the auction.
Love it. Fab, we talk about Fab in all formats. It's covered, the RotoWire guys do a great job recapping the main event Fab. We talk about main event and 12-team Fab on my Monday shows. No one really talks about auction league Fab, and obviously Fab is Fab. At the same time, league dependency is different. Do you see anything, we talk about 12s and 15s being crazily different. Do you see a difference in the auction leagues? Because if people are drafting maybe so many stars and scrubs or whatever, Fab might be a little different. So how do you see the Fab usually playing out on average on a week to week? So is it surprising to you, I should say?
And I said this in first pitch when Vlad kind of asked me to chime in a little bit on the auction, but I did a main event this year and I did two of the online auctions. In the main event, every single week, pretty much guaranteed, it was 40 transactions, maybe 50 transactions. In this league, it was more like 20, 25, 30 for a while. And then it was like 20 and then it was 15. So the online auctions kind of die out as far as activity. And you see that in the OCs as well, a format you do a lot. So yeah, I guess that's really the only difference. Otherwise, it's still 23 active, 7 reserves, NFBC, no IL. Everything else is the same. So yeah.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like those 12-team OCs. Just kind of like everyone's there, and then interest and everything else starts dwindling. And that brings back now to the strategy of bidding on your teams is if you're in it in the end, you can start guys for cheaper, and that's how you can get those saves and everything you're talking about. So it goes back to even draft day, drafting with that mindset potentially and going there. Before we wrap up this kind of auction discussion, is there any other takeaways or – things you like to any pieces of wisdom you like to instill to the listeners?
Yeah. So you had kind of mentioned that I noted that there was a lot of luck that was involved, but in all honesty, there was luck. No team that wins the overall is going to be unlucky. Let's think about it in reverse. So just kind of coming out of the auction table, if I didn't get Corbin Carroll for $24 and I did over 20 leagues, Bubba. And I only got Corbin Carroll in two leagues. So he was a guy that I was interested in, but he wasn't a huge number one target for me because he was not cheap. So that was kind of like, yeah, the overall team's going to have a Corbin Carroll. You know, it's going to have a guy like Josh Jung for $6, Josh Naylor for $6. And, a few other pickups along the way as far as hitting, but really the pitching is what set it apart with Garrett Cole for $35, Aaron Nola for $30. I thought getting those two guys would just give me a leg up on every team in the league for strikeouts. But what really set it apart was getting lucky again on a guy like with Freddie Peralta for $9 and Nate Eovaldi for $5. Cause I had Peralta and Eovaldi in both of the auctions. Those were two of my targets. And then kind of in the Fab wire, getting Bobby Miller, Tarek Skubal, and Cole Reagans down the stretch, there was some luck that was involved there. So I'm just saying, you build yourself a nice, solid team out of the auction, but you need to get lucky along the way because kind of like a DFS mindset, somebody else is going to get lucky or come reaching that most pure outcome. So you need to build yourself a solid base, but you also need to find some good fortune along the way too.
So when are you getting your Corbin Carroll jersey or something? Because $24 for Corbin Carroll, my goodness. Like we will never see, we'll never say never. We won't see that again for probably 15 to 20 years with Corbin. Yeah. Carroll. That's a price tag. It's like, you know, the current guy, like that's like McCutcheon. He was an MVP, probably paid $30-something for a couple of years or whatever, but now he's for like $6. It's going to be a long time until we see Corbin Carroll kind of take a dip again. That's wild. So
yeah, it was, it's just one of those things where you kind of look at it and there was some good strategy builds, but at the same time, man, you got to get some serious luck along the way. Cause there's 840 teams in this contest. So, yeah.
I guess the last thing I'll ask then is what is next for Lucas when it comes to auction? Are you sticking this one? Are you going to move up since you have a little extra scratch in that account? Are you moving up to one of the higher tiered auctions? Or are you going to hang out with people like myself and spend 50 and auction things off again?
So on the NFBC, of course, they have the big dog $1,500 Vegas auction championship. I'm not going to be going in any live events this year, unfortunately. Okay. So I'm not going to be in part of that, but they have the 150, the 250 and the 500. I might just join that 250. Or I might just stick in the 150s. I love this format because it's a good mix, because it's funny. If we were to talk about some of the other guys on my roster, you would laugh at how disastrous they were. Seriously.
That's the beauty of auctions, man. That's why it intrigues me so much, because, you know, you leave a snake draft, you're at the mercy of the drafter, you're at the mercy of your draft pick. You walk out trying to justify things because that's where your draft pick was. That's what you had to do. Where the auction, like, you can literally, like you say, get those, your targets, you got your targets, but of course you had to get some other guys to fill out your roster that you're already probably thinking, God, that sucks. I want nothing to do with them. They're going to be dropped soon. So that's the beauty of the auction, is it's a totally different beast.
Yeah. I mean, it's to think that I actually wanted, you know, to get an Austin Meadows for $3 or a Mitch Haniger for $4. I mean, it's humbling when you look at this stuff too. So, you know, can't get too high, can't get too low, I guess. But yeah.
You and Farhan Zarhidi have a lot in common then when it comes to Mitch Haniger. So enjoy wasting money on that guy. But it worked out well for you. If the Giants would have won the World Series, we'd be talking about the same thing. But you pulled it off. They did not. That's the difference between the two. But all right. Well, then I'll see you in the auction streets. We'll have some fun with that.
Hell yeah.
Let's talk about some second half standouts. And this is kind of it's a total shift from what we just talked about. We did some strategy talk. It's fun. But you've done a DC. I've done one DC so long ago, I can't remember when I'd gotten it, but I'm in an NFBC 50 right now. We have ADP out. I just pulled it up. There have been 12 completed draft champions leagues. So we have that for those keeping track at home. 15 team league, you draft 50 players, no fab throughout the season type thing. And it's how us degenerates get going for the 2024 season. We're going to talk about some players that had really good second halves. Look at their current ADP and kind of give our thoughts on yes, no, maybe so type scenarios. So we're going to kick things off here with one Zach Geloff. And Geloff, we all know, I'm a huge fan of, because I picked him up everywhere last year, and he had a great second half of the season for the Oakland Athletics, second baseman. He has an ADP of 133 right now, Lucas. And this is a guy that we saw, you know, plate discipline, maybe a bit of an issue, but the power speed can't be denied. And in 69 games, 14 homers, 14 steals, like that obviously projects out pretty well. So what are your thoughts on Zach Geloff the second half and going into this year with an ADP of 133?
You know, it's kind of funny. I just want to mention this from the outset. We talked about the redraft community's kind of anticipation of prospects or how they react to them. And I'm sure you remember, this was a huge debate whether you wanted Geloff or Soderstrom coming up. And Soderstrom went in the 500s in my DC. So, you know, it kind of shows you that we're making our best guesses. But as far as Geloff goes, you mentioned his strikeouts. I think that's going to be highly publicized negatively about him. And I get that. It is a concern, but I have his ADP here, and I pulled these ADPs yesterday at about 137. This is a player with a very high pull rate of almost 50%. He's got a 47% pull rate. And as far as barrel rate, 11% barrel rate, that's perfectly solid to produce 25, 30 home run power. And for steals, he's a high steals player that I would project for a 2020 floor. Average is a liability, but some guys, the Guilds is a good example. He mentions that batting average, you can have a 220 to a 260 range. if Geloff hits 250 next year, you're doing cartwheels. That didn't hurt you. Mm-hmm. That was neutral. So if you have a 2020 floor with upside for more and maybe a 240, 250 average with a floor of 220, he's going to have everyday playing time in Oakland. I'm not too worried about the park because he showed in at least one half of baseball that he can crank it out of there. And yeah, he's a guy I'm interested in. I think that's a very fair ADP. I'm not sure if I would call him a target, but he's a guy that I think is perfectly fine there.
Yep, I'm with you. I grabbed him in my current NFBC 50. It wasn't a target of mine either, but he kind of fell. I jumped on him. I believe that the 2020 upside, like you said, 250. A lot of these young guys, it's a different era of baseball, so like strikeout rates don't bother me as much. I do look at plate discipline. Like, I just don't want some guy going crazy up there. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But, you know, we saw what he did last year. I'm still a fan of what we got. So I'm in on Geloff. We'll see how it pans out. But, yeah, ADP of 133, I think, is more than fair for that talent level. This next one, I can't wait to hear your answer because everybody knows my thoughts on Nolan Jones. Huge Nolan Jones fan. I actually took him in round four of my NFBC fit right now. He has an ADP of around 60 in DCs these days. The guy went 20-20 in 100 games last year by hitting 297. So, obviously, if you want to project things out, could be a 30-30 guy, potentially, if things start clicking. Could also fall back because of the strike rates. When you look at Nolan Jones, what are your thoughts? Because I know I'm very optimistic, and some are very, very pessimistic about Nolan Jones. So, where do you land in the debate?
Yeah, like you'll see a lot of my takes, I'm pretty much in between. I mean, I see why some would take him. But for me, 30% strikeout rate, just based on the caveman analytics, that is kind of a number that does give me some concern. And he's actually right around that number. And in the minor leagues, he's been higher than that. But on the positive, 16% barrel rate is very eye-popping. So I understand why the drafters are so excited about him. I think as far as volume goes, he is going to reach 20-20. But my concern is that his ratio stats of his average are going to come crashing down. I would probably project more of a 260 average. So yeah, he's probably not a guy that I'm going to be taking in any drafts, but just kind of looking at him, contact skills, I think, you know, coming into this year, he was a nice bonus for the Rockies in the middle of the year, but for next year, I think there's going to be much more of a game plan against him since he's projected to be their best hitter. So I think he's going to be more of a focal point. Sure. So the scouting report is going to be more in depth in my mind. And one other note that I found that was kind of shocking was he had an 898 OPS against left-handed pitchers. And I just don't think that repeats next year. So it's going to drop the whole average and OPS line in my mind.
Great points. That's why I said he is a polarizing guy already this season. So we'll see where that lands. He's gone as high as pick 33, as low as 111. But 111 was in our draft did back in August. So take that with a grain of salt. So he's pretty decent draft points here. James Outman, this is a fun one. High expectations last year. You mentioned Vlad Sedler. He loved Outman. It started out amazing, disappeared in the middle of the season, finished pretty good though. So all things considered, not a complete disastrous season. Finished 23-16, but the second half was very big for James Outman. That got him back in the conversation. ADP of around 180. What's your thoughts on James Outman? Because I have mixed thoughts on him as well.
Yeah, so James Outman is a player that I kind of got introduced to in the Arizona Fall League a few years ago, and he just stood out as like a beast of an athlete, looked like a slender, just stud, and was very tall, muscular, and just kind of popped off the page, and he really wasn't a prospect coming up. He was a seventh rounder in 2018, and this year he was amazing in his first full season. The 32% K rate, I agree, is a concern, but he's a high OBP guy like Nolan Jones. I think the difference in the draft cost, though, has me more okay with Outman since it's 120 pick difference for his ADP. So in my mind, he's a potential 2020 guy, has a great barrel rate, and he's going to be part of a nice loaded LA lineup. This may not make people feel great, but funny enough, another guy that's on the rundown later on, this profile reminds me of a Max Kepler with steals. Yeah. So to get that around 180, that'll pay the bills if he can if he can repeat his season.
And I didn't do this on purpose because I made this outline over a week ago and I started my draft this past weekend, but the first three players all are on my NFBC 50 team. So it's and there's another guy coming up here, a catcher, which is also on my team. So I've looked at this going, maybe I'm buying in the second half too much. We'll wait and see. But I agree with what you're saying. That the only concern I guess I really have with Altman, which I think it will earn itself out, is playing time in LA, because that was kind of the problem last year. But it was there in bulk at the end of the season, even against lefties. And that's kind of the takeaway. I was like, okay, they wanted to see what he got with it. He produced. Let's roll. That's kind of my thing. Plus, they're going to be losing some more players this year, and we'll see how it goes. But I'm with you. If he can stick around and play pretty much every day, this ADP is pretty generous, in my opinion. So I'm liking it quite a bit.
Yeah, I think – and I had the playing time noted here as a possible thing to think about. But if you had a Josh Lowe –
yeah, true.
You never pulled him. I mean, some guys get to that level where if they can just have the upside for a home run or a steal on a high level each day, you just leave them in your lineup and you don't worry about finagling it too much. But yeah, it is certainly a consideration.
100%. Let's go to Chicago. Seiya Suzuki, highly anticipated going into last year. Got, I believe it was an oblique injury early on, or a groin injury. So he's kind of missed a little time to start out with. You could tell he wasn't completely all there to start out. But when he got healthy, and in the second half of the season, produced really well, finished with 20 homers, 6 stolen bases. And now he has an ADP of around 120, 125, somewhere in that realm in DCs. He's still a guy that I can't go all in on, even though I can see the talents there. What are you looking at when you see Seiya Suzuki?
Yeah, so with Suzuki... Matt Heckman, a great Twitter follow. If you don't follow him already, if you're listening to a fantasy baseball podcast in November, though, you're probably following the guy because he does good work. But he noted time after time, Suzuki's going to catch up to his underlying metrics. You're going to get the stats. And I was like, man, I hope you're right. Cause you know, he's one of those guys where when you're eating all that bad production, it just feels horrible unless you get it back later on. And in the second half, he was an absolute beast. From July 4th on, he had a 949 OPS. If you look at all of his just statistics, K rate, walk rate, isolated slugging, WRC plus, max EV, hard hit rate, all of them went up at the same time. Didn't sell out for power. In my mind, this guy is an all-around hitter, a guy that you can pencil in for 25 home runs, 15 steals, and a 270, maybe even a 280 batting average, hitting third or fourth for the Cubs. I think this is a great ADP, and kind of reminds me a little bit of a Brian Reynolds, where he gives every category, some a little bit more modest than others, but he gives you something everywhere.
I like that. I like that comp of Reynolds quite a bit, actually. Makes a lot of sense. So, yeah, that's the thing with Seiya. Like, once he got healthy, you see it all, and I'm like, okay, I should really like this guy. What's stopping me? So maybe I'll have to dig in some more on that, and that's why we're doing this in November, to see what we can navigate the minefields on. Let's talk Max Kepler. You just mentioned him with the James Altman minus the steals is Max Kepler. And this is why it's a fun one, because Kepler guy, like every year, you kind of like, okay, late round value outfielder, like 1 year, 2019, hits 36 bombs, goes 19 and 10 and 21. Like, we're just situated, like, everything fluctuates with him every season, except his on base percentage is usually pretty solid. That's a given. This last year, he hit 260 with 24 home runs. A lot of that came in the second half of the season when he got healthy. He led off a ton for the Twins, which was beautiful. And what's really intriguing of why I like him on this list, an ADP around 290. So what's your take on Max Kepler? Because year in and year out, like I said, I started it off, he's like a late round, let's see if we need an outfielder dart type guy. Well, he's sitting there at 290 right now. So what's your thoughts on Max Kepler?
So this kind of goes back to our previous conversation. I couldn't think of any on the spot, but so many outfielders went late. This guy went in the 23rd round of my DC. I filled up an outfield too early because I would have taken that in a heartbeat. I just didn't need it. Yep. But as far as Kepler, you had mentioned he hit 36 home runs back in 2019. I think just hearing that out loud for some players to get reminded of that is just like, holy hell. Just because that's such a big number for a guy like this. But, you know what you're getting with him. You put him into your lineup. If he's facing one lefty or fewer, if he's facing two lefties or more on NFBC, you pretty much sit him. I think he's likely to be like a 240, 250 average because just the way his batted ball approaches, he's a pull heavy guy. And he's a fly ball kind of guy where he's just not going to have a good average. But if you want like 20 home runs with 60 runs and RBIs. I think that that's a possibility. There's no steals upside though. So that's why he's going so late, but I think he's fairly, I hate to say reliable, but I think you're not going to get burned if you pick him.
Yep. I think you're going to get around 20 homers. He's going to lead off, score around 70-ish runs. You know, he's going to do his thing. He can almost like steals. If he gets you five steals, you're over the moon. The plan on probably zero, like type thing. The one thing I'll mention for those that are probably like throwing things at the radios right now or earphones, 2019 was the bouncy ball year. We're all aware of that. So that probably had something to do with 36 homers. But still, when you take a jump that high, it stands out. He's a big guy, massive pull power. So that's another guy to think about. But he's definitely a late round guy that I'd be all about having because people love Jack Sawinski. He's like 100 picks earlier or like 80 picks earlier. To me, like Jack runs more, but very similar mindsets also. So something to think of there. Chaz McCormick, this is a fun one. He did it in 115 games last year when guys were injured. He played every day. He finished hitting 273, 22 homers and 19 steals and 70 RBIs. Big second half going into the postseason for Chaz McCormick. ADP of around 105 to 170. Looks like he should be the everyday guy, I'll say. You never know because Dusty doesn't – he's not there anymore to play as veteran, so we got that going for us. But what's your thoughts on Chaz McCormick? Because he's a guy that the skill sets were pretty darn close to elite at times last year. Playing time was not.
Yeah, that's true. His playing time occasionally was kind of messed with, but he was another leave-it-in-there guy in 15-team leagues because what else are you going to do? Put in Alex Call from the waiver wire? So he was kind of a guy where I just left him in. Because you just don't want to overthink it. But, yeah, with McCormick, he's a guy that increased his pull percentage 10 percentage points from the previous year from 34 to 44%. And he used to go opposite field in 2022, 30% of the time. He reduced that down to only 23%. So he changed his swing approach. He's always been a 10% or higher barrel rate guy. You know, he's going to throw in 15, 20 steals for you. Since he's still in the prime of his career and he's a combo guy. And one thing that I thought was interesting, because I've kind of been a little bit of a Chaz McCormick guy in DC's past few years, just because he's been so cheap and he was getting regular at bats and produced pretty decent. If you look at this year, he was a 133 WRC plus, but if you combine 2021 and 2022, he was a 111 WRC plus then too. So it's not like he just became a good hitter. He's always been pretty good. I just think he got more playing time. And with Dusty being gone, I foresee even more.
My question for you, with Chaz having about a 165 ADP, he's about 15 picks ahead of Outman. Which one would you rather have?
Oof. You know, I feel Outman's the better call. I just think there's more upside with him. He's a few years younger. You're getting the benefits of the Dodgers development, although the Astros development's elite too. So that's kind of a wash there, but yeah, Outman just feels like he has more of a chance to go 30-20 than McCormick. Seems more of a high end compiler.
Yep. I think it's a very interesting debate. That's one to be fun to talk about this time next year.
That's a tough one.
A lot of similarities there. Bo Naylor, another guy that's on my NFBC 50 team. I'm big on Bo Naylor this year. Love the way he finished the second half of the year. Once the Guardians decided to play him every day, he produced in his 67 games with them, 11 homers, 5 steals, hit .237. Played just elite for me for a young player. It's surprising. ADP of 165-ish, give or take. What are your thoughts on Bo Naylor? Because, like I said, I'm a believer in what I saw. I think his ADP should climb, but catchers are also deeper, so maybe not. But what's your thoughts on Bo Naylor?
Yeah, guys like Bo Naylor are why I'm trying to wait on catcher. So I can hopefully get this guy at a discount. I could see easy top 6, top 7 catcher. And maybe more if he can figure out to run more. That was one thing that was slightly not the greatest was he stole 20 bases in 2022. But then last year, he only stole 7 bases. And that was actually over 500 plate appearances in each season. So it was similar. But kind of like you said, elite walk rate, so that's going to give you more runs than most catchers. It's going to give you more chances to steal. K percentage is very reasonable. He was sub 20% K percentage in some seasons throughout the minor leagues, so that's excellent. So I potentially see an upside for 20 home runs, 10 to 15 steals for Naylor. So it's kind of like a Dalton Varsho package with a little bit of a better hit tool and more OBP.
Yeah, I love the Varsho comp. That's literally a note I have of something I'm writing these days, is this could be your next Dalton Varsho. And he shouldn't lose catcher eligibility anytime soon. So it'll be good to see either. I think there's a lot of similarities between those two players. So get him while you can on the cheap. Let's put it that way.
With Naylor, and I know you know this being the catcher kind of guy, sometimes you look at a catcher, like Ryan Jeffers is a good example. You pull him up, you look at him, you're like, well, this is pretty good for a catcher. Bo Naylor, you don't need to put for a catcher. He could be,
exactly
an outfielder or a second baseman. You're like, this is just pretty good. And you get catcher eligibility.
And that's a great point. That's why I kind of like circling him and a few other guys in like the certain range going, okay, if I can wait this guy, I'm drafting a player for my team. I'm not forcing myself to take one of my two catchers. That's a great way of putting it. Because, there's a section of catchers. You're like, okay, this just sucks. I need to fill my spot. Like, Nick Fortes was hot for 2 weeks. Great. Let's go with this. But like you mentioned, even Ryan Jeffers, a great stream for, the last couple months of the season. Dude was a beast. And he was hitting in the middle of that Twins order, and no one probably even knew who, most non-diehard players, like you said, people listening to podcasts in November knew who Ryan Jeffers was.
Yes.
But other people that tune in like March, getting ready for their first draft of the year, they probably still don't know what Ryan Jeffers did last year. It's like as a shock to them, and don't realize he's the starting catcher for Minnesota for now. He could do it again, and it makes it very. And they'll see the ADP and go, "Why is he here?" And well, he kind of earned it if he's going to continue to be the middle of the order guy for the Twins. And it's funny stuff like that. Before we get to the next hitter here, we have a guest in the chat here. Yancey Eaton says, why didn't one of us win our main event league, Lucas? So disappointed in us.
Yeah, that's a good point. We had a fun battle. Yancey, he partnered up with good old Sammy Reed, and those guys were tough. But it was a fun main event league. It was my first time doing the main, and man, if your pitcher gets blown up, it just kind of ruins your whole mood for the night. Or, if you somehow get lucky and get, 7 or 8 home runs, it feels 10 times better. So it was a fun format.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I talked to Sammy once in a while. It was pretty fun listening to the conversations in that league. You guys had a fun one there, which is always a plus when you're playing fantasy. Brian Hayes, this is a good one. And he's going to pick right after Bo Naylor right now, according to ADP. In DC's around 165, 170 or somewhere in there. But when you look at first half, second half splits, this is why we're doing this. I should probably focus more on second half because that's the point of this. But the list was made based on second half production. Look at Brian Hayes, a lot of injuries, seems repetitive, evergreen tweet, as you say. But in the second half of the season, once Brian got healthy, 299 average, 10 of his 15 home runs, only one steal compared to 9 steals in the first half. So he stopped stealing bags, but hit with more power. We saw the elevation on the ball change. It started to show signs of what many have hoped for so long. So what are your thoughts on Brian Hayes? Are we buying on what we saw in the second half going into 2024? Or is this like, I still need to see more because he's always hurt. We don't know what it's going to be.
Yeah, so it's funny with Brian Hayes. I've kind of rostered him since he was a prospect for AAA Indy, kind of a local team to me. And it's been tricky because you've seen it in spurts. I think he's one of the definitive guys where he'll have a nice run and then he'll get hurt, or, he'll hit 230 with 4 home runs for a half a season. So to see this monster second half is enough for me to buy in. And it's because he's burned us a few times, so he's affordable. I actually put him on my DC in the 13th round, close to pick 200. So for a guy that possibly could give you 15 to 18 home runs, possibly could give you maybe 16 to 25 steals with a 270 average, just in all totality, it's going to come together where it could just be a nice solid line. Maybe not that superstar that we wanted a few years ago, but there's enough flashes in here for me to still go for it. And that elite defense will allow him to get as many plate appearances as he can handle.
Yeah, I agree. I'm very, very intrigued. It's a guy I've been in and out on over the last few years. Like, the price tag seems pretty good, especially for the base position, which has talent, but we always talk about it drops off a cliff at a certain point. Look, O'Brien is at least in the conversation now, which is very, very good to see. If he can stay healthy, it's the old thing. If he can just stay healthy, that would be a beautiful situation to be a part of. A handful more here. You mentioned Josh Lowe earlier. You know, he's a darling of many on a Twitter, Vlad and Ben Tidd and other guys. Love Josh Lowe. Started the season great. Hiccups in the middle. Kind of a James Outman feel, honestly.
Yeah.
But second half of the year for Josh Lowe, hit 311, 8 of his 20 home runs, stole 13 of his 32 bags. So that's a 20-32 season with a great batting average. His ADP is around 75-ish. He's going 120 picks ahead of his brother. It's pretty impressive. What's your thoughts on Josh Lowe during the season? Because it feels like the normal Tampa Bay platoon might be going away for him.
Yeah. He did play against a few righties here and there towards the end of the year. So that was at least beneficial to see. And, you know, he doesn't need to play against every single righty or every single lefty, excuse me, but it would be nice as much as possible. But I would say going from, you know, mid 30s K rate to around 25% K rate, amping up the power, 11% barrel rate, 30 steals. I mean, he's an elite athlete. He's going to be able to be in the lineup every day defensively if they're willing to trust his bat against those lefties. So his ADP around 75 initially was kind of, I don't know, but the more I dug into it, the more I'm okay with it. It is tough though to take a guy in the first five or six rounds that may not play every day. So that's the only hesitation, but as far as the skills, I think this guy's a stud. And yeah, I think I'm going to have a few shares where I can here and there.
Yeah, that's you just nailed the part that's still kind of tough for me, of the guy not playing every day situation. How do we deal with it? But man, he's a stud. So it's kind of maybe suck it up and go thing. We'll have to kind of see how the draft season goes along for Mr. Josh Lowe.
Yeah.
Tristan Casas, he's a very popular name on the streets these days. And that's because how he finished his season. The second half of Casas was amazing. 317, 15 home runs. Even drove in 38, which was great. But, you know, you dig into even more numbers, it's just nuts. You look at his slugging, 617, OPS over 1,000, ISO of 300, WRC plus at 174 in the second half, ADP around 112. What's your thoughts on Casas? Still comes in a bubble of really good, proven first baseman. So you have to kind of decide, do you believe and want to take the chance on the next step with Casas, or do you take kind of the boring, more proven commodity?
That's a good question, because I have his ADP noted here at 107, which that's in range where I would be able to do it. There's just other players that I just think are better players that are going after him, like Josh Naylor. Mm-hmm. I just think he's going to outproduce him, and you can get him cheaper, about 30 picks cheaper, in fact. So that's one of my holdups, but you're not guaranteed to get Naylor, so sometimes it might make sense to throw a Tristan Casas share in from time to time. I would think you're looking at a 30 home run guy with a 250 average. It might be hard for him to get 100 runs in RBIs, because I think he will play against most lefties to give him the development time. But if he needs to get a day off, it'll come against those lefties. So I'm not in love with this price tag, but I could see doing it from time to time. His first and second half skills were pretty similar, funny enough. So I think he kind of had some bad luck in the first half, and then fortune's kind of found his way in the second half.
That's a great point. That he was that skill based the same. So now can the luck go for a full season? I guess is the question. Can the skills produce for a full season? And that'll be interesting to see. Because yeah, like guys like Goldschmidt are going close to Casas, who's boring but proven. And yeah, you mentioned like the Nailers of the world, VP. Like there's a bunch of young other guys after him, which makes it very, very interesting. A couple more here. Royce Lewis. I think everyone knows who Royce Lewis is. Everybody in ADP rooms know who he is, an ADP of around 40-ish, give or take. And obviously battled injuries forever, but in the second half, we know that monster, 11 home runs in the second half, 295 average. We know the push was a grand slam, I felt like, every day from Royce Lewis. How are you, Royce Lewis? Price too rich for your likings, or are you cool with what we're seeing from Royce Lewis?
Yeah, I was absolutely flabbergasted when I saw what his price was, and I couldn't believe it. I understand that people pay more attention in the playoffs, and I know he had just crazy amount of home runs and RBIs in the second half, but ultimately this is a guy that's dealt with two torn ACL muscles or ACL tendons. He had a hamstring that affected him last year. He had an oblique. I mean, he's just had countless injuries, and you can't win your league in the first few rounds, but you can set yourself back. So for me, this is just way too much injury risk for me. And yeah, like I said, I was surprised to see that he was going that high, because I figured if he was going this high, he would have an elite, crazy elite barrel rate, or, you know, some underlying metrics. And a 12% barrel rate is very good, but it's not like it's a, you know, 18% barrel rate where people could just hope for 40 home runs. Maybe he could get a 40 home run pace, but I think durability, I'm going to give this guy a D to a D minus durability grade.
Yeah, he's the Byron Buxton disease all yep. over again. And it's a shame, because the talent is ridiculous when he's out there. Bryson Stott, this is one, and when we did the positional recaps, me and Bloomfield, and it really stood out to me, like, wow, I did not notice it was this good with Bryson Stott. Over 30 steals on the season. In the second half, you know, the average is down 53 from 301, but eight homers, 15 steals. Overall, the season was great for Bryson Stott, and ADP is 103. And I guess that's the biggest question here. He actually probably produced overall better in the first half, but the total season was good, and you're paying for it ADP wise at 103. So I want to get your thoughts on Bryson Stott and that price tag.
Yeah, Stott was actually a guy that I had on a lot of teams last year, just because I felt like he was very solid at everything. The only thing that he wasn't necessarily proven in was power. And I saw enough out of him where he would be able to provide that. But even just looking at his prospect card on Fangraphs, I mean, he's a 50 at everything except game power, and that's a 45 future value. So this guy can basically provide five categories across the board. Last year, he was dual eligible. And going into next year, I think he's a guy where you can get, you know, 14, 15 home runs and 25 steals. So he's not a guy that's going to fly up the board with a big name, but I think he's a profit center.
Yeah, I think that middle infield potentially, you mentioned second base and everything, could come into fruition with Bryson Stott to make your teams much more balanced and beneficial in the end. Jake Berger is a great one. I've always been a Berger fan, and to see it actually pan out in Miami was just oh so great, because of just all the mess that is the Chicago White Sox. In the second half of the season, primarily with Miami, but the whole second half, Berger hit 279 with 15 home runs. He had 34 home runs on the season, Berger, which is outstanding to see. ADP of almost 170 right now. So what are your thoughts when you look at Jake Berger this year, especially at that price tag? And you mentioned a position, he's that third base where he's going later than most.
Yeah, I knew he would go cheap just because he's not a big name or anything. But yeah, I think again, he's another one of those players where people see the name, they're not too excited about it. Among qualified hitters, he was third in the major leagues in barrel rate, 17% barrels. He's going to be in the 3 or 4 hole for Miami. So he's a potential 30 home run guy where you can just get him in, you know, what, the 14th, 15th round. And he's not sexy, but it's home runs and 50% pull rate with 17% barrel rate. He's going to be able to crank him again, I think, next year.
Yeah, I'm feeling that as well. I'm pretty pumped. He did it in that ballpark, which just stands out in a big, big way. Two more here. Kerry Carpenter of the Detroit Tigers, ADP of between 190 and 100, depends on where you go. You know, had some injuries early on, but really shined in the second half of the year, hitting 287 with 12 home runs, and he threw in 6 stolen bases. So when you look at a guy like Kerry Carpenter, especially that ADP, you mentioned outfielders going later, it's almost a 200 ADP there. What are your thoughts on Kerry Carpenter?
So kind of, again, with Jake Berger, whenever these guys just don't really have that excitement factor, they're going to be much more bargains. And Carpenter's a guy where he was kind of a 19th round draft pick, really was a no name prospect for a long time. And then in 2022 had a 3-level season where he went to AA, AAA, and then progressed to make a nice major league debut in 2022. And he literally continued it on this year. I think you're getting a 270 average with 20 home run pace. So you're getting average and power this late in the draft. And he even plays against lefties because he's a very just professional hitter. So yeah, he's a guy I'm a big fan of.
Yeah. I'm with you on that one. I like what we're seeing with Carpenter. I've talked about it a lot last year. I like what we did in Detroit in general. I think there's some fun there, some value to be had in the fantasy world. So I'm all about that. The last one I'll mention that many saw in the World Series and the whole postseason is one Evan Carter, because his entire season took place in the second half of the year. He hit 306 with 5 home runs, 3 stolen bases. We saw gains even in the postseason. His ADP is only 150. Honestly, thought it'd be a lot higher than that. So what's your thoughts when you look at a guy like Evan Carter?
Yeah, so with Carter, you're getting really plus everything from team context. He's on a World Series, elite offense. He's got 80 grade makeup from what I can understand. And he's a hell of a fielder, going to be able to steal some bags for you, and has a pretty good hit tool and an amazing on-base percentage. But as far as where that power shows up, it's hard to take anything from his major league sample. And it seems to me like drafters are just automatically putting him into that 20-25 home run area, which may be fair, may not be fair. Because, Bubba, I kind of viewed him as like a Brandon Nimmo with more steals. Fair. So it seems like his ceiling is well beyond that. And I think he's going to have more helium, like you basically said. And I just don't know where to put that power. If you can bank him for 15 to 18 home runs, you might be able to get him, but I think he's going to be a helium guy, like you said.
Yeah, that's where I'm kind of torn on him. Like, the talent looks great. You know, everyone's talking about Wyatt Langford coming up at some point in time. So it's like, where does it all go, I guess, is my question, when it all is said and done. All right. We wrapped up all our list of players there. I got two listener questions for you before I let you go, because you've been very gracious with your time here. Our buddy Ben Tidd, he asks, as someone who's considering signing up for the new NFBC Champions League qualifier, but is hesitant because he's never done an auction before, what's the biggest difference in your prep from a snake draft versus an auction draft? I think it's a great question.
That is a good question. If you've done your prep for the snake draft, you've gotten yourself a head start, but they're really two completely different entities. And I'm sure Ben's thought a lot about that, and that's why he's asking the question, but you really need to view it as two completely different things. So I actually wrote up an auction primer on my website from last year, and that's kind of like just all evergreen content that you can just read and it will apply. I did stuff for deep league, shallow leagues. So I think just kind of getting your strategy in place and having pivot points, because I know Ben's a map your draft out kind of guy. So he'll be able to do that for an auction, which that's probably one of the similarities, which is huge. You need to be able to map out, I think, to do really good. Having your specific targets, I think, is another really crucial thing. I learned that from Brody Johns, where he had 4 or 5 guys at first base, 4 or 5 guys at second base. And that way he's never stuck where, oh crap, you know, this guy went off the board, I don't know who I want next. If you have as many options as possible, certainly a huge, huge asset to have in your back pocket. But there's just so many differences. They're just kind of two different entities, I guess, is the way I would summarize it up.
Yeah, that's the conundrum. That's why we're having conversations on auction versus drafts, which is very, very, very interesting to me. But yeah, check out the articles that Lucas has put out there. I'm going to go check them out myself. And then Kelly Kirby asks, how much less are you spending on only hitting Ohtani?
Yeah, it's another good question. I had a few Ohtani shares last year just because you're getting a 40-20 guy. Utility clog things up, but I think if you're a good drafter, you can draft enough multi-position eligibility guys where you can mitigate that loss. And I planned on using him as a 2-start pitcher when those 2 starts came and there was only a couple, or on a 4 or a 3 day week or weekend coming out of the All-Star break and into the opening season. So you basically have to just factor him as a hitter only, with the risk that he doesn't start the season on time or has injury related interruptions, which for me, being a completely non-risk type drafter, I would need to see him just raking in spring training. I would need to see excellent comments from the manager that he's on set, he's on stage to start opening day, because these teams aren't going to give two craps about your fantasy team to start him on time. They want to make sure his health is the priority number one. And if he signs a $500-700 million contract, they want him right 10 years down the line plus. So I think they could potentially be cautious with him. Now they may say, let's get our money's worth. Let's let him rip, but they're going to err on the side of caution. And so am I, and I'm going to fade him until I see good news. Even in that early second round, I don't even really like that right now.
Yeah. I think that's, I honestly don't know what to them. I'm not the expert on any of that kind of stuff, but I know I've been very torn on. I'm usually anti-Otani to begin with because I don't know what to do with him. Let's put it that way. So you start throwing. Now he's hitter only, and I agree with you. Like I said, whatever contract he's going to get, there's going to be a chance for an opt-out next year. There's going to be so many moving pieces in that contract that it's like the team that gets him is going to probably get him for cheap year one, prove it year two, and you're healthy and can pitch, and then we move on from there type thing. That's why I see so much of taking place on this. Maybe I'm overthinking it or whatever, but that's kind of the way I see it. I'm like, this is going to be a different beast type scenario that we haven't really seen when it comes to building out those type of situations. So I guess we'll see, but it's a good question because I am very curious as now I think we all are on how that'll pencil out. But yeah, it'll be quite interesting. All right, my friend. That'll wrap us up. Any final thoughts as we covered a lot of ground here, and I appreciate your time.
My final thoughts are, if you have any remote interest in getting into an auction, just go ahead and do it. My first auction, my plan sucked and I was horrible. And I was lucky to finish in like seventh or eighth place many years ago when I first did it. And I knew my screw ups. So I was like, well, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. And then every year I just tried to make less mistakes, and it's going to be obvious what you messed up and how you can improve. And you monitor other guys in the room. You're like, oh, he did a good job by, you know, when everyone only had $1, he had like 10 extra dollars to spend on like six guys. So he could go $2 on a few of them. So it's not rocket science. It's just a different way to allocate assets towards fantasy baseball. And I highly recommend people to jump into it because most everyone I've talked to, that's an auction player, from a Jake Hallisker to Toby to Rob D, almost all of them say this is their favorite format. Gives you a chance at every player in the player pool. And in my mind, that makes it more fair.
Yeah. And I'm with you. That's one thing I've heard as well. That's what's kind of intrigued me to do it is I like that idea of, hey, it's a big, like you said, you get your guys, you have a chance that you're not at mercy of, you know, the snake draft, like we were talking about earlier. It's a great way to do it. And then once the draft's over, obviously it's a learning curve to do it. And that's why I've asked you questions and other people questions is in the end, after the draft's done, now you're playing roto like you play any other time.
Yes.
And now you're doing your fab. And so after the draft, it's the same league you play any other time. That's another, seems very simple, but I think some people might even overthink that, honestly. It's like, it's they think the whole league's different. And all it is when you draft is different. Other than that,
that's it.
Game on. It's the same. We all play. And that's why I'm very intrigued with it. I know everyone's price points are different, but like this online, it's $150. That's in my, like, I'm willing to take a few chances on that. There's going to be other cheap formats. You know, I'm probably speaking at school here, but there's enough interest. I know the people at NFBC are very friendly. They do other leagues for other podcasts. Maybe I can get us like some $50 Bubba Bench with Bubba or Bubba Moon auction leagues, like 12 team leagues just for fun, standalone leagues outside of just if you want to get your toes in the water and play, we can have some fun with that. Because I think I won't speak for you, but from everything I've heard from everybody else, the NFBC auction platform, drafting platform software is phenomenal. So, yes. And I'll ask, it's and what I asked you used. Before is,
bar none, yeah.
And how long did your draft take?
I want to say it took less than 3 hours.
Which is amazing, which is outstanding for an auction, folks.
Yeah, it was, because I'm just trying to kind of think through here. It's been about, 7-8 months since then. But I want to say that you do a break like every 8 or 9 rounds. So you do like a break after like the first 8, then you do a break after the 16th round. And then I think once the reserve rounds are about to start after your 23 are on your team, then you do another break. So it's like 5-minute breaks. And Derek from NFBC, he was like, all right, break's over, boys. Let's get it rolling. Like he's churning this thing out. So
beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah, because I remember I've done like a Fantrax one back in the day, and it was like almost 6 hours, and I'm like, I can't do this.
Oh wow!
Like, I have a daughter. I have other things. I'm like, I can't. This is not going to work for me. So like that's like my been my biggest concern. But when I hear 3 hours, heck, we do snake drafts that are 2.5 or 3 hours. Like that's just the nature of the beast. That's without breaks. So, yeah, that's very intriguing to me. Last question, I guess I have for you. I should have asked you earlier. You know, we do KDS for snake drafts. Mm-hmm. How do you set where you're going to throw out picks, and do you have a preference on where you are to throw out picks?
So that really does not factor in whatsoever, really.
Okay.
Except for the reserve rounds.
Yes.
Because if you're the 15th guy, then you get that first pick in the reserve round. And it's not every draft. It's not every draft, but there's some drafts where it's a guy that, holy crap, how do we forget about him? And he's just sitting there in reserves. So that happens sometimes.
Okay, good to know. There we go. All right, on that note, we'll wrap it up. If you guys want more information, go check out dcdynasty.co on the internet that Lucas has, and go check him on Twitter at Lucas Beery, B-I-E-R-Y. 33 on the Twitter, or X as some cool kids call it. But as always, Lucas, it's been a pleasure, my friend. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
All right, this is Bench with Bubba, episode 611 with Lucas Beery. Catch you up here.